Chapter 24. Charlie was thrilled to bits. They were home and safe. Only Bex had to be on duty again first thing. "Get this damned visit over, Charlie," she said, in a sort of flat monotone. "Get it over, then Joe Bain says I can take some proper leave." This wasn't the old Bex he knew and loved. This Bex was much more serious, preoccupied.
"Sure, Bex. Where'd you like to go? Anywhere special? Just tell me, old love, and we'll do it. Slow boat to China, road to Mandalay, up the lazy river, Camelot, anywhere you want. Say the word and we'll do it."
But Bex wasn't really thinking. She was far away. She hadn't really come back yet. Give her time, Charlie. He remembered Patsy's warning.
"Where do they want you? In the morning, I mean."
"Heathrow. They want me there when they arrive. When Oleg Bortunin arrives. Want me in close, looking at faces. That's what Commander Bain said. Let DCI Oleska watch the faces. He reckons that it doesn't matter what disguise he's taken on, I'll be the most likely person to recognize him."
"You want company? Want me to come along for the ride?"
She looked puzzled, as though she couldn't understand why on earth Charlie would want to schlep all the way out to Heathrow with her. "If you like," she said, in a tone that translated into, "No way, Charlie." So he drove her out, noticing that she wore a shoulder holster rig under her suit jacket, noticing that the holstered big Glock was set hard against her ribs on the left side, directly below her armpit, noticing that she seemed more quiet than usual, noticing the wariness that came into her eyes, noticing how she seemed to shrink the nearer they came to Terminal 4. Armed Royal Marines were on the gates that led down onto the low building and the apron in front of it. As they got nearer, there were signs of other uniforms, men in camouflage jackets on the roof, weapons all over the place, men with clear, watchful eyes. A sergeant guided them into the parking area, precise, making sure they went exactly where he pointed and nowhere else. A tall man, back like a ramrod, shoulders like a bullock, face carved from grey stone. "Better hang on a second." She cocked the Glock. Charlie saw her put the safety on and slide it back into the holster, button it down. She got out and walked to where her commander, Joe Bain, stood, talking to another uniformed cop, Patsy Wright, a man Charlie recognized but couldn't put a name to, and a colonel with the Royal Marines commando flash on his shoulder and the green beret on his head. The colonel looked as if he could kill for England. Sunburned face, lived in, held himself with pride, hand occasionally straying to touch the holster low on his webbing. Charlie saw them glance over in his direction, almost heard Joe Bain say something, then watched as Patsy walked over with Bex. "Commander Bain says you're family, Charlie. Says you can come on over before he does the O group." Charlie was just out of the car when a whistle blasted, and a handful of men seemed to materialize from the buildings, the roof, and from a helicopter that stood about half a kilometer to one side. Half a dozen men were standing around the chopper, wearing jeans and ski masks, and carrying assorted weaponry. Charlie knew who they were before he saw one of them doubling toward the O group, SAS, the elite. He saw the colonel of Marines turn away with a smile. The colonel was thinking that he did not have to wear a ski mask in public. A pair of young commando subalterns trotted toward the colonel, stopping and saluting, heels together, shoulders so square that you could have used them for a geometry lesson. How wonderful to be young, well-trained and fit again, Charlie thought. Then he saw Beck smile and changed his mind.
"Move in and relax. My name is Joe Bain, and I'm the assistant commissioner in charge of the anti-terrorist branch. This morning I was summoned to a meeting of COBRA, which, as you know, is the acronym for Cabinet Office Briefing Room. The briefing room committee was called into session in the early hours of this morning, when it became clear that neither President nor Madame Bortunin was going to take steps against a very serious threat to their safety while they're here in the UK. We informed the President of the situation, and he apparently spoke with his security people, who told him that we have probably the best security forces in the Western world. So he says that he feels quite safe about coming, even though the threat is extreme. This being the case, I have to inform you that we have ordered the Russian presidential aircraft not to land here at Heathrow. In the interests of the President's safety, the aircraft is being diverted to Northolt. Only a very few people are being advised of this action, which is with effect from... Bain paused, looking at his watch. With effect from now. I have a trained police presence at Northolt, including officers from the Special Escort Group and two police helicopters. You are instructed to remain here until I have clearance to stand you down. I must also tell you that the press are not being informed of this change of plan, so I would ask you to remain alert. It is possible that the sharp end of the threat is actually here, in this vicinity, at this moment. It could well be a mortar attack, or an RPG-7, or something similar. I have four patrols moving along perimeter roads. Anyway, I suggest you do not, I repeat not, inform the men under your command, as I am anxious to be sure we remain watchful and vigilant. Thank you. As the various officers made their way back to speak to their men, the black official rover came quietly through the gates to the side of the building. It paused, then moved forward, parking just short of the building. Hello. Bain kept his voice down. Either someone hasn't received my instructions, or we have an unauthorized visitor. He scowled and muttered into his mobile. Charlie saw the Marine Colonel's head come up, felt the static, glanced at Bex, who was just turning, her eyes registering surprise, then the frown forming. Bex was thinking, I recognize that girl in the rover's passenger seat. In retrospect, Bex thought it all took an age, her thoughts moving slowly down the wrong end of a telescope. Is she one of ours? Not her features or her hair, but I know her by the way she's sitting. Right shoulder slightly forward, weight on the left buttock. Back straight, but her chin tilted arrogantly to a certain angle. Where? Seen her. Seen her recently. Bex froze again, uncertain, mind humming down the pathways of memory. Then, Jesus, she suddenly knew. It's them, she said quietly. It's the woman, Tess Murray, an alchemist. It's them. The Marine Colonel heard, and his pistol was out almost before she finished speaking. As the pistol came up, both hands steadying the butt, legs apart, the man at the wheel of the rover reacted, slammed the car into reverse, and gunned the engine. The car screeched backward, burning rubber, and the Marine Colonel did not hesitate. He fired twice, straight into the driver's face. The windshield frosted over, then was drenched in blood, while the rear of the car thumped hard into the closing gates. Stop! Shouted the colonel. Stop! Get up with your hands up! Leave the car now! He had switched targets, starting to squeeze the trigger, just holding back, hesitating. Other weapons had materialized. Troops and police, plainclothes officers, men and women, were forming a crescent in front of the car. In the passenger seat, Tessa Murray sat rigid, her body taut, trembling. Some of Ronnie's blood had jetted from his head to her face. Jesus God, she thought. Ronnie's head had exploded just like that watermelon in that Day of the Jackal film. She was conscious of her pronunciation. In her head she said, film. Anything but the real matter in hand. Logic tripped through her mind. Ronnie was dead, she knew that, and accepted it. They had failed, but at least the death was quick. Her left hand touched the door catch, and her right slid under her jacket. She unbuttoned the strap over the butt of the Browning, drew it out, and flicked off the safety. She'd really had enough, didn't want to go on without Ronnie. Until the very last moment she was scared, keeping the truth hidden at the back of her mind. She pushed the door open and turned her body, feet onto the ground. Now, she thought, push up and away, then start shooting. Take some of the buggers with you. Tessa was on her feet. She turned. The pistol came up in the double-handed grip, and she was squeezing the trigger, both eyes open, looking over the sights toward the first target. Turn from the waist. Don't move your feet, Tessa. Now, just in case, on the off chance. An act of contrition. Dear Lord Jesus, save me. For all my sins, I'm truly sorry. And in that fraction of a second she saw him, with his pistol held at arm's length. She even saw it buck and move as he fired twice. Even though some 15 years or so had passed, she saw him plainly and recognized him before the blinding light struck her brain
and she was swept away. Joe Bain, Bex Oleska, and Patsy Wright held weapons. Charlie was touched that Bex had elbowed him out of the way, standing with both feet firmly apart, shielding his body with her own. "Thank you, Colonel Docking," Joe Bain called out, and Ralph Docking flipped on the safety and turned away as uniformed police officers ringed him, safe from the cameras. Colonel Docking looked around, clearing his head. He had seen the girl. Oh, Sandy Mount, he thought. Rory Deacon, all those years ago. Oh, God, he whispered. That was it, a Sunday morning, walking along the Strand at Sandy Mount. How young we were then, a few years ago. There was nothing in brooding, nothing gained by wondering what might or what might not have been. He walked away, his back straight, and the sidearm holstered and safe. In his head he played the loop of memory, the Canaletto print, the tall ceiling with the crack in it, then the spray of the sea and the smell of the sea, the great barber's pole chimneys out at Poolbeg, and the sound of a horse being ridden up the Strand, half in the water, as it went past the two young people, with their hands clasped tight, as though they would never let go of one another.